Good afternoon, and welcome to A Public Affair. My name is Patty Peltakos, and I will be your host for this edition. It is Monday, February 29th, 2016. We'll be speaking with today's guest, Lloyd Gardner, Professor Emeritus of History at Rutgers University and author of the newly published book, The War on Leakers, National Security and American Democracy from Eugene V. Debs to Edward Snowden. So now, without further ado, let's welcome Lloyd to A Public Affair. Hi, Lloyd. Thank you for joining us today.
Fine, thank you.
Hi. So, Lloyd, your book, The War on Leakers, National Security and American Democracy from Eugene V. Debs to Edward Snowden, has just been released. Its publication coincides with a court order that Apple must assist the FBI by breaking the passcode on the iPhone used by Syed Rizwan Farouk in the recent San Bernardino shootings. So far, Apple is refusing to comply. The War on Leakers also comes out a month after the Pentagon released 198 photos documenting military abuse in Iraq and Afghanistan. As noted on the American Civil Liberties website, the photos were released in response to an ACLU lawsuit that we have been litigating for almost 12 years. The ACLU had requested the release of 2,000 photos documenting torture, in addition to many other materials. They are still waiting for most of those photos. And of course, we still have a long way to go in our current presidential campaign. The candidates have not spent much time ripping into the topic of government secrecy, but we do know that Donald Trump has said torture works. Lloyd, you've written quite a few books on recent American history, especially about U.S. involvement in the Middle East. In The War on Leakers, you've put together a concise history of the 1917 Espionage Act and its use or misuse by so many of our presidents, especially President Obama. Could you just give us a brief description of what the Espionage Act is and Just a brief, concise history for us to clue us in.
Yeah, well, the Espionage Act was passed in 1917, and it was passed shortly after Wilson asked for a declaration of war against Germany. And the purpose of the act, ostensibly, was to track down and prosecute people who might be dealing with the German government or with agents of the German government. In practice, however, the first big use of the Espionage Act was made against dissenters, against the draft, particularly the socialist candidate for president in 1912, Eugene Debs, who spoke out early and often against the draft. And it was also used to shut down periodicals like The Masses and so on, to prevent anti-war, as they saw it, anti-war sentiments from being distributed through the U.S. mails. So, after World War One was over, and Debs was actually imprisoned on the basis of the Espionage Act, even though he had never dealt with any foreign agents, or the judge who sentenced him said that the government did not even have to show that he had any contact, only that it was his intention to damage the war effort. He was put in prison, and he was in a federal prison until 1921, when Warren Harding came in. And as part of the total rejection of a lot of Wilsonian practices internationally, Harding pardoned Debs and freed him from prison. So then we don't hear very much about the Espionage Act for a long, long time. In fact, the next big time that it comes up is when Daniel Ellsberg publishes or gives to the New York Times and the Boston Globe and other newspapers the Pentagon Papers. Those are called secret papers about the narrative of how the United States got into the Vietnam War. And at first, President Richard Nixon in 1971, when Ellsberg did this, thought this was going to be a real boon to him because, hey, he didn't get us into the Vietnam War. And then the more he thought about it, the more concerned he became, and he ordered Attorney General John Mitchell to find some way to lock, to put Ellsberg away. So they invoked the Espionage Act after they failed to stop the papers from publishing the Pentagon Papers. So the Ellsberg case became famous, and it was never really settled whether or not the government had any sort of case against him, because at that time, at the same time, Nixon had sent the plumbers out to California to get into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. And when the judge at the case discovered that, he declared that there could not be a trial. It was a mistrial. And so the issue of the Espionage Act was off the table, for at least for the time. And then we come down to the post-9/11 period, and George W. Bush began using the Espionage Act against leakers. And then Obama, President Obama, came in, and he's used it more times than any other president in trying to get after people who leak documents. And all this time, there's never been a question of it being to foreign agents.
Right. Can you tell me, how does our government go about categorizing or classifying our secrets? And if we have a government that is of the people, by the people, for the people, then who gets to say what is actually a secret? And who gets to decide what should be withheld from the people?
Well, that's one of the big arguments. The government insists that newspaper people, media people of all kinds, cannot be the final judges on what is to be secret and what is not to be secret, and that individual citizens, whether they are qualified journalists or not, cannot take it upon themselves to divulge secrets which affect national security. And, of course, national security is invoked all the time to justify these kinds of things. And as the classification system has gotten so big that so many papers are classified every year, millions, it's become a real question about what is actually in the national interest and has to do with national security and what is simply an effort to avoid embarrassment. So we have a standoff here.
Mm-hmm. And so, in thinking about what is actually a secret, and what documents and materials can be classified, how did the Espionage Act influence, or did it have an influence on the formation of intelligence agencies in the United States?
Yeah. Well, you see, to begin with, unlike other countries, particularly European countries, we do not have an Official Secrets Act. We have never had an Official Secrets Act. The Official Secrets Act, as they operate in other countries, really focus on the material itself, whereas the Espionage Act focuses on the person who gives the material and the people who print it. So there's a big difference there.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we don't have an official Official Secrets Act is because the Constitution guarantees freedom of speech, and also in Article 4 guarantees against unwarranted searches. So to get around this problem, the government has started using the Official the Espionage Act. And indeed, many of the actions that were brought under George W. Bush were continued in the Obama administration, and the Attorney General Holder argued that if they dropped those cases, that would be bad because the attorneys had spent so much time working up the cases. Well, what this means is that no president really can challenge the intelligence community. If it carries over from administration to administration, how can you believe when President Obama or any future president talks about change you can believe in, because you can't have change. You have continuity that you have to accept.
So, Lloyd, can you give us a sense of how many intelligence agencies we now have in the United States?
Well, that's part of the problem, too, isn't it? In the sense that they created their own problem, they created their own Snowden problem because of the tremendous increase in the number of people who work at the NSA and who work in what is called the intelligence community as a whole. It is, in fact, the fastest-growing branch of government. It's not actually known as a branch of government, but that's what it's become, a branch of government. And if you look at the buildings in Washington, the number of people who are employed, it's tremendous.
And is it a part of the Department of Defense?
Ever since the advent of the digital age, the fastest-growing branch of government.
Do the intelligence agencies like the NSA, does it fall under the sort of the general heading of the Department of Defense, or is it really a department all of its own? And likewise with the CIA and the FBI?
Well, there are differences there. The NSA really has to do with signals intelligence, at least it did. And much intelligence is now gathered through signals intelligence, whereas the CIA and FBI were more relying on human intelligence.
And by signals...
What was that after 9/11, the NSA got into this huge, big dragnetting of mega information, mega data, and this put it then in the business of listening in on individuals, and so that the difference between signals intelligence and human intelligence began to get fuzzed over pretty bit.
Mm-hmm. And so by signals intelligence, are you referring specifically to communications sent via telephone or over the web using the internet? Are those the types of...
Yes, that's signals intelligence.
Yeah. Okay. And given that we now have so many people who are employed in these intelligence agencies but who are not necessarily government employees, do we even know what those people are doing?
Well, there is a so-called black budget in the Pentagon, and I suppose that carries over into all the intelligence agencies, so that we don't know exactly how much is being appropriated each year for the intelligence agencies, either individually or in combination, but it's a pretty big sum, no question about that.
Mm-hmm. So you write, there has always been a campaign against leakers, and inevitably entangled with it, a desire to put leakers and protesters in the same bin as foreign spies and cast enforcement actions in terms of a balance between liberty and security. President Obama seems to have taken that campaign to a new level. Can you give us a sense of why President Obama in particular
I think, you know, when he was running for president in 2008, he said that he did not want to simply end the Iraq war. He wanted to change the mindset that got us into the Iraq war. And then in the interim, between 2008, his election, and his taking office in 2009, some big changes seemed to come over him. He appointed, for example, as one of his experts to tutor him on these matters, John Brennan. Now, he wanted John Brennan to become his first CIA leader, and Brennan was very caught up in Catholic just war theory, and he talked with Obama about that, and you can see in Obama's Nobel Prize winning speech the influence not only of Martin Luther King, but of Niebuhr, Reinhold Niebuhr, the realist Protestant theologian, who stressed the question of just wars, too. And I think that in just the last few days, a man who'd been imprisoned under the Espionage Act for releasing the name of a one-time clandestine agent, John Kerouac, who spent almost 3 years in prison in Pennsylvania after being convicted under the Espionage Act. Kerouac says that he has a lot of information, and from people who talked to him while he was still in the CIA, that the most important influence on Obama was John Brennan and his whole take on things. Now, then, when Obama came into office in 2009, instead of doing anything about the enhanced torture techniques in terms of an investigation, he said that we had to look forward instead of backwards, and that he did not want to do anything to make it more difficult for members of the intelligence community to do their job. So that very early in the Obama administration, he had already been won over to the other side. And since that time, his biggest fear has been that he did not want to get caught between the intelligence agency and those of his supporters and others who are calling for a change in policy. He's done everything he can to try to avoid that.
Lloyd, William Binney, Thomas Drake, John Kiriakou, Edward Snowden, Laura Poitras, Glenn Greenwald, Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning. How have their stories opened a conversation or opened a debate about our government's collection of private data?
Yeah, well, let's start with Snowden, okay? When Edward Snowden made that tremendous leap of faith, so to speak, and released all those documents, he caught the administration unawares, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because President Obama had talked about the need to make the population of the nation more comfortable with what the NSA had been doing, because there had been previous stories, including those by James Rissen of the New York Times, about what the government had been doing. And in fact, one of those stories had appeared as early as 2005, although the government managed to block it for a time until Reason said he was going to publish the information about the NSA net in his new book, Pay Any Price. So what happened then was that in 2013, when Edward Snowden released all that material, Obama now had to do something more than say that he wanted to make the nation comfortable with this. He had to eventually, as more and more papers were leaked, he eventually had to appoint a commission, and that commission reported in December of 2013 on steps that could be taken to try to end this problem as they saw it. And they wanted really not to eliminate all the programs, but to modify them to take more account of the need to get warrants, to have more to do with the special court that had been appointed to determine whether warrants were advisable and so on. So that ever since Edward Snowden's actions, the other agencies in government have been scrambling to find some way to rationalize what they do with what is in the name of democracy. So now the tech companies also took up the fight. They had been somewhat willing before to cooperate with the government on practically anything it wanted. And ever since then, and you see it in the headlines today, in what Tim Cook has done at Apple and the others following along somewhat reluctantly in challenging the government. So that was important. Kiriakou was put in jail or convicted, presumably, for releasing the name of a former clandestine agent, and there had been an act passed which made it a crime to do that under the Espionage Act to release the name of a clandestine agent. But really, Kiriakou argued that he was convicted because he had blown the whistle on the waterboarding torture back in the early days of the Bush administration, Bush II. So Kiriakou did not go quietly into prison. Instead, he started writing letters from prison, and this a column. He had an outlet to major news sources, and so he developed quite a big following himself on the web and in other places. And then you have Chelsea Manning, who dumped so many papers. It was the largest single document dump through WikiLeaks that had been known. And the government adopted an almost medieval religious attitude toward that. You know, in the Middle Ages, if the church put books on the index, even if you knew the books, even if they were out there and for sale, then you were not supposed to read them on pain of mortal sin. And this is what the government said. It told its own people they could not read documents that had been published in the New York Times because they were still secret and so on. And that was how far the ridiculousness of the situation went. And so now, one of the great ironies of the recent past is that candidate Hillary Clinton, who at one point said that what Snowden had done was definitely illegal and was a danger and that he should face justice at home, now she's facing her own crisis in terms of the emails from her private server, and she makes the statement that we have a ridiculous classification system. So there's not a little hypocrisy involved in those kinds of statements. But I think that what has happened as a result of Manning and Snowden and Kiriakou and Thomas Drake, whose case also caused a great uproar because he opposed the system in the first place, I think that their boldness, their coming out, so to speak, has forced a national dialogue on this whole question that wasn't there before, despite the fact that President Obama says that he was working to change things before Snowden. But that was really not an effective argument after the revelations.
So, Lloyd, I'm going to go off on a little tangent here, but I wanted to ask you, if you could ask the presidential candidates about the Espionage Act, about the intelligence services, and how they might reform or not reform them, what would you ask them?
Well, I think most of the nation, unfortunately, still doesn't know anything about the Espionage Act.
Okay.
And so if you were to stand up at any one of these debates and ask about the Espionage Act, you'd probably get a lot of puzzled looks, and that's unfortunate. But what you could do, I would think, is if you got up at the debates and said, look, what do you think about the way in which the government has to punish leakers and so on? Is there anything we can do which would protect national security and at the same time still be in confirmation with our interest in democracy? And how would you go about changing the laws? I wouldn't use the term Espionage Act. I would say, how would you go about changing the laws so that that is possible?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very difficult question. And what happened today, if I can talk about this for a minute,
Certainly.
Happened today is that the government on the San Bernardino case to try to get back a lot of lost territory. It was still on the defensive, despite everything, despite what happened in France and so on, because people kept pointing out, well, how indeed did the NSA programs prevent any terrorist attacks? And the answer was from President Obama's own commission that he appointed, from Richard Clark, it didn't prevent a single terrorist attack. But now he has the San Bernardino case, the Justice Department does, and it wants to pursue that and to force Apple into making a backdoor into its phone. But it isn't just simply one case, although that's what they're using. If once this happens, there's no way of taking back what you have done. So now the tech companies have stood up where and picked up, in a sense, the banner where it was left by Snowden. And if I could talk about Snowden for a minute.
Oh, of course. Yes, certainly.
Having Snowden in Russia in exile is great, in a sense, because here he is in Putin's government, which is no friend of democracy and so on. So if he were going to be loose, it would be the very best place for him to be, in the sense of the way in which the government wants to play the public relations.
Lloyd, in keeping with your discussion of the case with Apple, how do you see us as citizens protecting our civil liberties when our communications technologies seem to know almost every detail about our lives, and when so many of our private details are available in some computer or some digitalized form? How do we protect what should be our private information?
Yes, well, okay. Now, to begin with, the government has used that argument. They go back to a Supreme Court decision in 1979, which involved a man who had used the phone and had given his information to phone companies for billing and so on. And the government said, yes, well, once you give that information to a corporation, then, in effect, you have released this information. And the Supreme Court upheld this in some cases. And the judge, most recently, a judge ruling on this, said that the notion that a 1979 ruling about regular phones could be the same as mass collecting data is just ridiculous. But the second important point was that the phone company does not have any power to put you in jail or does not have any power to subpoena you to witness at any point. So now the question becomes, where do we go from here in terms of how a person protects one's data? Now, the tech companies have their answer, and that is that they're trying to encrypt more and more. But there's no question, anybody who uses Google email or any of the other email services will see these ads popping up on the side, which indicate that they've been reading what's in your emails.
Mm-hmm.
And they know what's of interest to you in terms of commercial products, in terms of health concerns, et cetera. But again, the government has the power to use this information to prosecute you. Google can only try to bog you and bother you with advertisements. So right now, I don't think there is any particular way in which the people can protect themselves against this kind of intrusion. And the Senator Leahy, and in fact Sensenbrenner, Representative Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin, both felt that the government's ability under the Patriot Act to do all these kinds of things, as the interpretation was made by the Bush administration, went far too far. And so in the Freedom Act, Leahy and Sensenbrenner actually teamed up in an effort to curtail a lot of this. For example, the question of when the government goes after a specific individual or a specific case, the government wanted a broad interpretation so that it could go after the communications, say, one night in a hotel of all the residents in that hotel. And the people who argued against this, like Leahy and Sensenbrenner and so on, argued that it must be much more specific. So that's all yet to be adjudicated. We're still in the middle of this debate.
Do you have any hope that Congress will be able to revise our laws to protect our privacy?
I do and I don't.
Well, I gathered that reading your book.
it's created new political alliances between left and right. And the old alliances, the party alliances, don't necessarily hold firm on this question. You have conservatives or libertarians aligning up with left-wing or liberal Democrats on this question against a lot of those people in the center. So that whether or not Congress will ever be able to do anything or not, I don't know. I would hope so.
And also,
I think there have been important strides in the sense of judicial actions against the government.
So you also write in the book about how the intelligence agencies have really contributed to the imperial presidency. Could you tell us a little about how executive orders have been used, especially by President Obama, and how that feeds into the building of an imperial president?
I have a feeling that the imperial presidency, a lot of people say it began with World War II and all the agencies and the beginning of the OSS in World War II. But I have a feeling that the real beginning of the imperial presidency was with the atomic bomb, because we had assumed that our national security was going to be a technological fix, that we would have the bomb, we would always be ahead with the bomb. In fact, President Truman, when he announced the dropping of the atomic bomb, said that no other nation could do this. Well, 4 years later, the Soviet Union comes up with an atomic bomb, and Truman says, okay, well, it was spies. Spies gave the bomb to the Soviets. So we had the Rosenberg trials. We have the whole scare of the 1950s. And our frontier of defense moved from Hiroshima and Nagasaki to Virginia, to McLean, Virginia, and to Fort Meade, Maryland, where the NSA was. So now we were trusting in intelligence to be our big protector. And so we couldn't challenge anything that came out under the rubric of national security. And that's where it seems to me the intelligence community gained its great foot on the ladder of the imperial presidency. It's wrong to talk about an imperial president, I think, anymore. It's really an imperial presidency.
Okay.
The whole conglomerate, not a president. And I think the president himself is intimidated by the intelligence community.
So, Lloyd, we have just a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask you, what do you see going forward, and how do we go about diminishing the role of what seems to be this giant octopus force controlling our government that we have not elected?
Right. Going forward, well, it seems to me that it's not just simply a question of taking on the intelligence community itself. It's a question of foreign policy, so that you have to be willing, it seems to me, to accept that the world is just simply not going to dance to America's tune, and that you can't have a policy which hopes to solve all problems everywhere all the time. And we have to start by redefining what our national security really is. And that's something that we haven't done very successfully for a long while. So that we have to really have some arguments about the bedrock of American foreign policy. And then, of course, we have to, it seems to me, deal with the fact that the digital age is here, that it is both a powerful force for good and a powerful force for danger, and that no solution is going to be good for all time. But we have to, in a sense, accept the progress that was made under the way the Freedom Act was passed widely. And it's right, it's not as good as some of the tech companies, not as good as a lot of the absolutists on the side of privacy would like, but it was a step forward. And every time something like that is passed, it marks a precedent marching in the opposite direction from the total control of the intelligence community. So we have to accept incremental steps, it seems to me.
Okay, and I think we will have to wrap it up right there with talking with Lloyd. Lloyd, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and talking with us about your book, The War on Leakers, National Security and American Democracy, from Eugene V. Debs to Edward Snowden. It is a powerful read, and I hope listeners will pick it up and read it, because it will really make you think about our government and mm-hmm. what we are doing here in America. So thank you again, Lloyd. And
Thank you.
Oh, you are so welcome. And thank you all for listening. Bye-bye, yeah. Everybody.